The moment where I really realized, like, you gotta bring it every single night in that arena. I never spoken this on nothing media or nothing. I think we was 4 or 5 games into the season. We was playing the Knicks. And I took the game winner. I airballed. And I just felt the whole vibe of everything. Like, what the f***? What was that? I felt like I disrespected the aura of what these fans is used to seeing from, obviously, MJ hitting game winners. And, you know, you live for those moments. And to be in that moment for the first time, my 4th, 5th season in the game, and I take that shot, it was like, I told myself I would never be in that situation again to let that same feeling happen for these fans. Mm-hmm. I swear to God, bro, I never told that. It was that game to where it was like, every shot I take in a clutch, I'm going to make it count every single time. So you look back at all the moments that I had in that arena, it was more so like, I'm trying to inherit the ghost of Michael shooting his fadeaway with the clock running down. Like,
absolutely. That's,
I carried that to heart after that moment.
DeMar DeRozan talking about inheriting the weighty Jordan responsibility. Wow. Well, for a team that's under 500, 3 games. That team, DeMar DeRozan's team, will be on the air tonight on The Score. 6:45, Chuck's pregame show. 7 o'clock tip-off in Cleveland. A chance to get embarrassed again, lose again. I mean, this is a team. You see, if you ever doubted how mentally and emotionally weak this team, this roster is, that Arturas Karnišovas put together, or Karnišovas, it's Lithuanian for Garpax. This is how weak it is. When you see a team fall apart, tank, soil the bed, the first game after the trading deadline, you have a bunch of players who were weak. They were all afraid they were going to get traded. They all exhaled. They all said, hey, it doesn't matter now. They can't trade me. That's how you know you're dealing with mentally and emotionally weak players. And that's your Bulls. That's what happened. They go to New. The Nets traded their 2 best players, and they didn't get everybody back in the trade. And they had a bunch of guys they grabbed off the parking lot, and they beat the Bulls. There you go. There's your Bulls. And Arturas Karnišovas needs to look at players the last 27 games just to really find out who they are. Paul Sullivan, do we know who these Bulls are? Do we know who they are, and can we help the guy who's Lithuanian for Garpax along so he can move along with this? Hi, Sully.
Hey, Rosie. I think it's a little too late for that. I don't know what he saw that the rest of us aren't saying, but I mean, it's pretty obvious they don't have a point guard, which was something that they needed going into the season. Maybe they were counting on Lonzo getting healthy, and it doesn't sound like that's going to be the case this year. Your leading assist guy is DeMar, and that shouldn't be his job. No 3-point shooting. It's just a lot of shortcomings that are pretty obvious if you've watched the team, not just this year, but ever since Lonzo went out last year, which was in January. They've been around or under 500. So, you know, for him to say that he needs to see them all together longer, it just doesn't seem to ring true to me. I think they just didn't feel like making any moves.
There was a stench of Garpax in this whole thing. What he said, how we sounded, we're evaluating our team. We didn't think it made it better, and likely they were overvaluing their prospects. So if you're going to make the connection, by the way, I'm talking with Paul Sullivan of the Chicago Tribune, writes the In the Wake of the News column. And he joins me on the Score Hotline, presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. It had the kind of stench that leads me to believe that whatever Reinsdorf du jour is running the franchise, there are some kind of financial implications, because it sounds a lot like Garpax. You need names. You need people. You need names because you're going to ask people to write big checks and write playoff checks, and you can't give them any more Dalibor Bogarić things. You can't do that anymore. You have to have something here, or it's Karnišovas's refusal to admit that he doesn't know how to build a team. So which do you think is likely?
I thought he did a good job building the team last year. It's just he hasn't really audibled when he needed to. And I understand they would be a better team if Lonzo was healthy. But, you know, counting on that after, you know, the summer when he obviously told everyone he wasn't going to be ready again, it just is a head scratcher. I know they got Goran, and he's a nice, you know, piece off the bench, but he is certainly not a guy that is going to come into a team and change things. Andre Drummond, nice piece off the bench. Probably should be playing even more, but Billy really doesn't let him do that too much. So I think that he kind of blew it this offseason when he had a chance to make some changes and then just expect them to improve. And obviously that has not happened. And like you said, you know, you don't want to, you can't really say, well, Jerry Reinsdorf is doing this, but he does own the Sox too. And they really are following the same kind of pattern there where you're just expecting the team to get better. They're a 500 or less team and you're not going to make any moves because you're just going to believe that, you know, these guys are going to get healthy and play better. And we saw that that didn't happen. And I would be very surprised if it happens to the Bulls. I still think they can make it as a play-in team, but I don't know what you think. I don't really expect them to go beyond, you know, maybe they'll even win a play-in, but they certainly couldn't beat any of the top teams in the East.
Well, that's who they can beat. They beat the better teams. The problem is in the play-in team, you're playing teams as crappy. In the play-in situation, you're playing teams as crappy as you are, and the Bulls can't beat them. But that's the goal. Should the goal – you got six Larry O'Brien trophies. Do you really – is the goal to make a play-in?
Apparently.
Oh, my God. Okay, so then you're looking at – so you wrote about it this week.
I mean, they could still get the sixth seed, I guess, if you want to be real about it. They're not that far behind. I think Miami's six at this point. But, you know, let's get real. I don't think that's happening.
So you wrote about it this week. The obvious comparison between the Sox and accepting mediocrity, and that's where they are. And by the way, they still have problems in right field and second base. Isn't this where we started last year and nothing happened? And you're hearing the guy who's head of the Reinsdorf basketball operation saying, well, we like our guys. We think this is really talented. We need more time. They either need more time to figure out who they are, or they really like their guys because the league told them that. There's just such stupidity or hypocrisy or lying going on, and you hear kind of double talk from the White Sox too. So share with the class you're comparing and contrasting these two franchises.
Well, basically, I was just looking over what Hans said last year at the trade deadline when he didn't make any moves besides the big Jake Diekman deal, which was really nothing.
Legendary.
Yeah. And he started talking about, you know, I really feel for, you know, I'm with you Sox fans, very disappointed, wishing we could have got something done. And Arturas kind of stuck it out with the same thing. Yeah, I feel for Bulls fans, you know. But, you know, you just can't keep saying that. Every other team, except for the Cavs, as it turns out, made at least one move at the trade deadline or before the trade deadline. And the Cavs, you know, got Donovan Mitchell in the offseason. So that was a pretty big move that probably one the Bulls should have explored, knowing that he was available. So I don't know. You don't want to put it all on Reinsdorf. But, you know, he does own the two teams. I don't think he's really that involved with the Bulls. Honestly, I think he's basically let Michael Reinsdorf pull all the strings there. But, you know, he's still the guy. And when both of your teams are, you know, kind of using the same blueprint, you got to wonder.
I don't think I have to wonder at all. I think I've come to certain conclusions.
Do you think that he's really that involved with the Bulls right now, or do you think maybe Michael's just the, you know, chip off the old block there and has the same philosophy? Or
I think the business concerns, the business demands, the business implications of having names and stars and asking people to write checks run counter to a smart basketball operation and maybe a smart baseball operation. I think that's what happens.
Well, we do know that this Benintendi deal was the biggest in Sox history, and that was, you know, $75 million, a lot of money, but I'm sorry. Excuse me, I got some caught in my throat. But the Bulls have gone over the luxury tax, I think, once in their life. Mm-hmm. So you can't compare them in that respect.
The other column you wrote this week was when LeBron James passed Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to become the all-time leading scorer in the NBA. And so the GOAT discussion came up again, Michael or LeBron, and you wrote about that, wondering, wonderfully so, why are we so protective of somebody who doesn't live here, is trying to sell his home here, and has been for what seems like 10 years, and barely comes back here, and yet we cling to him, or it seems like we do. So share with the class that and what you think about this kind of discussion.
Well, it's, you know, these kind of discussions are always going to happen, you know, greatest of all time. And I have nothing against that. And it's fun to talk about. And my theory is just let LeBron have his way. He thinks he's the greatest of all time. His fans obviously think that. I don't think Michael cares really that much. I think he knows his place in NBA history, in gym shoe history. They're making a movie out of Air Jordans. You know, in cartoon history with Space Jam. I mean, he was really a trendsetter and a culture setter in so many different ways. So really, the NBA really took off, you know, because of him, not just because of him, but certainly had a lot to do with his emergence. Whereas LeBron, kind of great player, probably best post-up player that we've ever seen, but, you know, he's not Jordan in that respect, and he never will be. You can even argue that, you know, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird were more important to the NBA than LeBron. So my thinking was just, you know, it's a silly argument. Who cares? Let him say it. Let him have it. We know what Michael did. Michael knows what Michael did. Just kind of let him have his title and let's move on. I mean, he's going to obliterate the record by the time he's done. He's still good, still very good. And he's, you know, 38 years old. He wants to play with his kids, or at least one of his kids. So, you know, if you think that being the top scorer in history means you're the greatest player of all time, you know, okay, fine. Look at Babe Ruth. He was passed by Hank Aaron and then by Barry Bonds. But certainly his impact on baseball was, you know, way more than Barry Bonds. So it's not just the points. It's not just the stats. It's what you bring all overall to the game that really is what matters.
At a time where the NBA could take over, they stopped calling traveling. They stopped calling palming the ball, which meant they featured people like Michael Jordan flying through the air, and the grace, the athleticism of it all. And he was the best at that. So the league helped him as well at a time when basketball was coming of age in TV, making the most, changing from what league that was, the cocaine-infested league that it was in the 70s. So all of that worked out, and whatever Bird magic started, Michael continued, and he perfected it. And yet, the barometer Michael used, a quote that I saw came out in the wake of LeBron, was, "You think I would have retired in 93 if it was all about passing Kareem and doing that? It's about championships. It's about winning. It's about rings." Well,
I thought that was an old quote, though, wasn't it? That's not something you just recently said, was it?
I remember seeing something like that before. I don't know if those were the exact words. But by using his definition, whenever he said it, then he was bowing to the greatest of all time being Bill Russell and his 11 rings. So LeBron and Jordan together don't have as many rings as Bill Russell, the biggest winner we've ever seen, which I thought was real interesting for Michael to bring that up at any point. And Bill Russell, whose game is largely forgotten, but you can go look it up. He was the greatest winner in NBA history.
Yeah, and there were some other players with more titles as well. I can't think off the top of my head.
I think Casey Jones is one of them.
Yeah.
Joined him there.
So, yeah, if you're going by titles, well, certainly that's not the case. But I think one thing Michael has over LeBron is 6 for 6. He never lost a NBA Finals. And LeBron, I think, 4 for 10, which is great, you know, that you've helped your team get to 10 finals. But, you know, if winning is the ultimate, then, you know, he didn't succeed in that respect.
Wow. 4 for 10, 10 NBA finals. That's like, you can't even have it unless LeBron is there wherever he is. And he did it with three different franchises.
Yeah, no, he's totally a great, great, great player. What, you know, but you would think that he would at least accept that, you know, maybe that he did follow Michael's lead, and that Michael, he should have even mentioned Magic and Larry, honestly, but he does have this ego that's amazingly strong. Maybe that's why he's so good, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Sully, I'm glad that these questions exist so that we can talk and we can write and talk about
it. Yeah, gives us something to argue about.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks for your time, Sully. I appreciate it.
All right, Rosie. Take care, man.
All right. Paul Sullivan, in the wake of the news column in the Chicago Tribune, and talked to a colleague of his, Julia Poe. She covers the Bulls. They're playing tonight. Well, they're scheduled to show up tonight. And you'll hear it on this radio station. Whether they play or not, we'll find out. What will happen on this radio station, the big game coverage on The Score Sunday, presented by Sota Weight Loss. That's S-O-T-A. Visit SotaWeightLoss.com. Stevie Suckage, talk more Bulls, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
It's Saturday Suckage on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
We've made a ton of calls. Obviously, we received a lot of calls. We had a lot of good players. And the thing is that, you know, in this market, there were a lot of buyers, you know, and not a lot of sellers. Every team still thinks that they are still in it, and that creates, you know, the market that it's very hard to make deals. And, you know, we thought that the best opportunities for those deals are going to be during the draft and free agency.
That's what you say when you utterly failed at the trade deadline. That's what Arturis Karnišovas was saying on The Score and Mullane Haugh on Friday. That's what you say when you have just soiled the bed and you're trying to sell this descending team that is mentally and emotionally weak. And again, here's one way you know. It's not just they can't start, or it's not just that they can't finish, it's not just that they don't play for each other, that there's no leadership, but when you see the trade deadline come and go, and you see the Bulls put on a performance against the Nets, a Nets team that lost Durant and Kyrie Irving in the same week, a Nets team that didn't even get Michael Bridges in uniform, a Nets team that pulled four guys off the playground, maybe they were practicing for the Rucker in New York, and they beat the Bulls. That's a team that just exhaled at the trade day. All those guys, I'm not going anywhere. What can they do to me now? They can't trade me. This is a mentally and emotionally weak roster put together by the guy who couldn't, wouldn't, hasn't changed it. That's my view. Julia Poe of the Tribune, you cover the Bulls. What's your view of the mental and emotional wake-up of a team that does what you saw them do with the management not making a deal and then the team not making much of an effort to win a basketball game?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question for them right now. Thanks for having me on to talk about this. You know, it felt a bit incongruous to have a team, you know, your EVP come out, talk that strongly about consistency, and then have a game like they did in Brooklyn where just the energy wasn't right. And I think that's the biggest thing that you keep coming back to with this team is that there's obvious needs. They need certain things that they don't have with the personnel that comes down to the front office. But there are these games where they come out flat in the first, they come out flat in the third, they fall away in the fourth. And a lot of the times, it just feels like that's coming down to, like you said, a certain level of energy and mentality that just isn't clicking. And we've got less than 30 games left now for them to try to figure that out.
Julia Poe is my guest. She covers the Bulls for the Tribune. She's joining me on the Score Hotline, presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. Julia, what you wrote today, it as Paul Sullivan and I were talking about earlier, this is like reading about the White Sox, another Reinsdorf production. The White Sox still have a problem in right field. They didn't do anything about it. They're trying to clown you into thinking Eloy Jimenez can play right field. The Bulls have this problem with three-point shooting. You wrote about it, and they're trying to clown you into believing they all have these different hacks to it. So share with the class what you wrote about and what you think of the way the Bulls' stance is.
Yeah, it felt a little bit strange. So, you know, the Bulls are not a strong three-point shooting team. We've known that since last offseason. The front office knew that at the time, the coaching staff, everyone was in agreement. We came out of last season and they said, okay, we need to go get three-point shooters. And they didn't in the offseason. Goran Dragic has been a bit of an upgrade there, but that's kind of fallen away a little bit as the season goes on. So you get to this point in the season, you're at the trade deadline. This is the dead last team in terms of attempts. And they're middling in efficiency in terms of their accuracy, but they're still making bottom five three-pointers in a league that is dominated by three-pointers. And that had kind of always been understood, but Arturas comes out after the trade deadline and says, actually, I feel like our rate is fine. I think we're doing well. We need to do other things better. And I think that's just kind of where it feels a little bit strange to me, just in terms of this is a team that has known this is a weakness for close to a full calendar year now. It's very visible on the stat sheet. It's very visible when you play against Brooklyn and you get outshot 10-0, 10 made three-pointers to zero in a first half against a team that, like you said, just got stripped of their star players. It's just, I don't know. It's hard to know what to make of that, you know, when that's the answer to those questions about arguably the biggest weakness on this roster.
Are they playing fans? Is Arturas playing fans for stupid, or doesn't he care about them? He just knows he has to go out and say anything. He has not been available at all. He's not commented on any of these highs and lows. He was sort of forced to come out, and it didn't seem like he had a lot to say. Then he came on the Mullinghaus show, and he was asked questions, and it seemed like a whole lot of gobbledygook. Is he dismissing the fans, and he's lying to ownership, or are there financial constraints because playoff checks, because next year's season ticket checks, because there's a lot of asking for money that a basketball team needs to do maybe at this time of year? I don't know, because he doesn't sound much different than Garpax, and he's not moving or doing anything much different than Garpax. And if that's the constant here is your random Reinsdorf in charge, I don't know if you know that there are financial constraints that would prevent him from getting rid of a name because names sell tickets. Do you know whether that's a consideration or not in this case?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first, I will always appreciate the fact that figureheads, whether it's in sports or politics, sometimes just have to come out and say whatever the company line is. Like, I get that. We work in this industry. We know that. I think when it comes down to the actual spending of the money, though, that's really where the question lines up, because this roster is in a very funky position between having a max contract player, having a guy as expensive as Lonzo sidelined. I mean, you've heard this spiel probably so many times at this point. We know that they're in that complicated position. I think the question is just, you know, Arturas has talked a lot about the cost was not worth the benefit for them at the trade deadline. And I think when you've got a team that's under 500, that's where those question marks come up, because it's just like, okay, well, at what point does the cost have to be worth it? And I think that's the conversation that they're going to need to be having in this off season, when you do have some of these contracts coming up, when you've gone long enough of having Lonzo's salary, you know, not for his fault, but just not give you any benefits on the actual court. I think those are kind of those conversations that I guess they're going to have to punt down the road now to the off season, because they clearly weren't effective conversations at the trade deadline.
Julia Poe is my guest. She covers the Bulls for the Chicago Tribune. So I had a question, and I'll just say it this way. Project the Bulls starting five next season for me.
Oh, man. I mean, in an ideal situation, we're going to see Lonzo make that wonderful healing recovery over the summer. I think everyone in basketball would like to see that. So in an ideal situation, you'd love to see him back in the starting lineup, just in the NBA in general. That would be beautiful. Given how uncertain things have been going, though, I do not think that you can right now definitively count on that. Arturas has made it clear that he would like to have Vooch back next season. So I think unless things significantly change on the forefront of them actually prioritizing three-point shooting and something happens one way or the other definitively with Lonzo, I think you could see a decent amount of the starting lineup come back next season, which at this point with where this team stands is definitely concerning. I think a lot of people would like to see a lot of changes made there, but it's just kind of hard to tell where this team will go when they've been preaching consistency and actually sticking with it, especially when, like I said, Arturas did commit to saying that he would like to bring Vooch back this summer if they're able to get that working out. So there's a lot up in the air in terms of that, but I think it's really going to rely, like I said, on Lonzo's health, which everyone wants the best for, and then also on whether or not they actually do commit to some of those re-signings that they're currently saying they want to do.
How tradable is Zach LaVine?
That's a good question. You know, any time that you put a player on a max contract, it obviously kind of skews the way that you're going to be looking at him on the market. We saw that there were some of those reports of maybe some interest, some small conversations around him happening around the trade deadline. And I think a huge part of it, like you said, about when we get back to talking about committing to names and wanting to keep certain names aligned with a team, is whether or not the Bulls are willing to go away from this project that they've been committing to for so long. They've been defining themselves around Zach for so long, mm-hmm. and whether or not they're willing to decommit from that, which given their slowness in decommitting from anything, I think that's kind of where you start seeing some of that concern, is just they have not been quick moving in pulling the trigger around, okay, we need to do a chemistry rebuild. We need to do, you know, a rebuild or kind of blow things up or look at things differently. They've been very slow moving with that, at least over the last two seasons.
When you can't pull off a trade with the Knicks, you're really, because that's all Bulls GMs have survived on, is pulling off trades with the Knicks. Mm-hmm. And you can't even do that. And the Knicks love the name. Thibs wouldn't want him. I know that. But New York would. They believe names sell tickets. And then it seems to me the Bulls are looking at it the same way. And yet he doesn't. You know how you know a Hall of Famer when you're watching them, as opposed to just looking at numbers, the way that discussion goes? The idea of watching what a leader is, what a leader does, I don't see that in my highest paid guy if I'm the Bulls. Do you see that? How would you characterize his version of leadership?
Well, I think that's what's so interesting about the makeup of this roster, is that Zach LaVine is 100% like the highest paid player on that team. He's been the backbone in terms of actual stylistic building that the Bulls roster has been built around for years now. But if you put anyone in a locker room next to DeMar DeRozan, DeMar DeRozan's going to be at least the co-captain, at least the co-leader. You know what I mean? Like it is very difficult to make a locker room 100% your own when you have a guy that's just that veteran, that experienced, that much of a leader. And I think that is, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but when you've got a guy that's going from being a young star to being kind of in that middle period where you're not quite yet the vet in a room, but you're kind of wanting to build yourself into that, I think it can be difficult to define a locker room entirely around yourself when you have someone just of DeMar's caliber, besides skill, just the way that he is looked up to around the league within a team. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but it can make it really hard, I think, for a guy in Zach's position to define himself as the figurehead when you've always got someone else of that level right next to you who's also going to be defining the locker room in such a strong way.
And doing it better. I mean, DeMar has far more experience at being in that situation. He's learned from better people. He's watched better people, and he's done an excellent job of growing into that and being that guy that you want to follow or be around. I mean, there's just so many examples of what he does better in that era, in that regard, that Zach doesn't have. He doesn't have that background.
Definitely. I mean, I was talking to some players about that this morning, just about how when DeMar arrived in Chicago, it would have been really easy for him to walk in and kind of have that "I'm DeMar DeRozan" swagger of like, this is who I am. I'm taking this locker room over. And he did almost the opposite of that. And he was really praised for that by his teammates, of just the way that he was able to come in and earn that respect in a really natural way. And I think that's why you see, I mean, with All-Star Weekend coming up next week, you know, you often see DeMar getting way higher returns from players and coach voting in All-Star than in fans. And that's because the people in the league know what he's about to such a strong level. So I think that's a big learning curve for, you talk about leadership with Zach LaVine. I think that's a huge learning curve for him, of learning from this guy that he hasn't really had that figure in his locker rooms always. If he can figure out how to have that rub off on him and then do it in his own way, that's going to be huge for him. But that's one of those things where it has to be very purposeful in terms of him wanting to learn that.
And not dribbling off your knee in the fourth quarter. Or an ankle or any body part. I don't know. You had the whole bingo card of body parts he might dribble off of in the fourth quarter. So I have one last question for you, Julia.
For sure.
Julia Poe is my guest. She covers the Bulls for the Tribune, and this one may require all of your great intellectual skills. But Sean Sears, my producer, put together a web poll today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry I didn't get Sully to weigh in on this, but I'm going to ask you. My current rapper name is Chance the Rabbi.
Okay.
And I'm thinking of changing it to Lil Flop Sweaty. So what would you go with? You have to choose one.
Oh, man, I love Chance the Rabbi. I love that. I would stick with that 100%. That's beautiful. I wish you had asked Sully about this. I would have loved to hear his take on that.
He would be laughing. And all right. Well, that's good. So we'll put you down for Chance the Rabbi. I think
put me in that one.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Julia. Appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. You have a good one. Appreciate it.
Julia Poe, she covers the Bulls for the Chicago Tribune. I will take a break. And we have the cultural zeitgeist collection of stuff to do. And we lost a great one, but a great one had a birthday. Just classic stuff. And Dennis the Menace. Do you know who Dennis the Menace is, Sean?
I do, yes. I do know who Dennis the Menace is.
What do you know of Dennis? Whence do you know Dennis?
So I know there was a comic strip originally. I do remember there was like a 90s kid movie made about him as well too. But
you know, do you know there was a 60s TV show?
I did not know that actually. No.
Okay. Well, then we will discuss Dennis the Menace. I didn't know this existed, but I have a Dennis the Menace story. So I will share that cultural zeitgeist. On Saturday, Suckage, Stevie Suckage for now, and apparently Chance the Rabbi. How is the voting going? Chance the Rabbi versus Lil Flop Sweaty.
Chance the Rabbi is still up here, 57-43 right now over Lil Flop Sweaty. So
it's kind of held that way.
Yeah, it's been it's steady. Chance the Rabbi is a crowd pleaser, I think, but Lil Flop Sweaty is pretty funny.
Yeah, well, Lil Flop Sweaty is showing a little flop sweat. He might not win this thing. I just thought we'll run it up the. We'll see what the listener, what our audience.
Thanks. I do have someone from the audience here, someone from Twitter actually tweeted saying that your name could be Dr. Dreidel.
Dr. Dreidel, that's excellent. We'll do that next week. We'll consider that. Dr. Dreidel, that is so good. Saturday Suckage, Stevie Suckage, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
It's Saturday Suckage on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Got a lot to do here, Stevie Suckage, on Saturday Suckage, and not a lot of time to do it. We have to be off the air in time. You know why, don't you? Because at noon tomorrow, we have a secret radio show. At noon tomorrow, we have a secret radio show starring a man imitating Les Grobstein, replaying what Mark heard on The Score. Mark Rohde doing a show, 12 to 1 tomorrow. Another secret show at 3 in the morning after the Super Bowl. Trash Panda will be there. So there's your promotion, boys. That's about it. I can't use any.
You're trying to be a wise guy. What you're doing.
Can't use any of the words you tried to get me to say on the radio. Big game coverage on The Score Sunday is presented by Sota Weight Loss. That's S-O-T-A. Visit SotaWeightLoss.com. So, guess who turned 80 this week, a couple days ago? Tommy DeVito. Well, the guy who played Tommy DeVito in the movie Goodfellas.
You mean, let me understand this, because maybe it's me, I'm a little f***ed up, maybe. But I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you, I make you laugh, I'm here to f***ing amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
I'm not just, you know how you tell a story, what?
No, I don't know, you said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. How the f*** am I funny? What the f*** is so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
Get the fuck out of here, Tommy.
I almost had him. Stuttering prick. Yeah. Frankie, was he shaking?
An iconic scene. And did you know Sean Sears? That was ad-libbed. That was not scripted.
Really?
It was not planned. Joe Pesci had talked to Martin Scorsese about it and said, I got this thing. I just want to spring it on Ray Liotta. And we're going to do it, and we're going to do it in the Bamboo Lounge, and we're going to, and that was it. And they all went along with it, and that's what that scene was. It was all.
I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you.
All unscripted. So that was Joe Pesci. He turned 80, and in my world, that's his greatest role. The second greatest role, some people will agree with me, as Vincent Gambini, a lawyer in My Cousin Vinny, appearing before Honorable Judge in the South. Are we going to play that?
I don't know if I have the cut. I'm looking for it.
Oh, my God. Sean, you suck. All right. Utes. The two Utes. Did
okay.
you say
okay.
Utes? All right. We'll move along from there.
Vin, it's time to make your opening statement. Come on, Vin.
Everything that guy just says. Thank you.
No more questions.
All right, and Marisa Tomei won an Oscar for that. That was just My Cousin Vinny. He was outstanding. And we lost someone who is legendary in our world here. Suzanne Hanrahan passed away at 83. That's how she is known by a lot, but a lot of Score listeners will know Suzanne Hanrahan as the wife of the estranged wife of the goalie Paul Newman taunts into running out of his net and beating him up when Paul Newman, as Reggie Dunlop, tells Hanrahan, hey, your wife's, well, maybe not what you thought she was. And Suzanne Hanrahan would go on to play, would also play, it just seems so opposite, her role in Slapshot, she would go on to play the mom in A Christmas Story. It couldn't be more. Melinda Dillon died this week at 83. So anyways, the Dennis the Menace story that I was telling you about, the Monterey County found its statue, missing statue of Dennis the Menace. There is a statue in Monterey County in California, Dennis the Menace, that got stolen, and they found it off the coast. And so they returned it to where it was. They knew it was because somebody broke off the statue of Dennis the Menace from the comic strip. And you knew him from the comic strip, right, Sean?
Yeah, that's what I had Dennis the Menace comics growing up.
In the 1960s, Dennis the Menace was a television show where he tormented Mr. Wilson.
We're going to have a nice, peaceful day in the country.
Ah, I can hardly wait.
Ah!
That was it. That was Jay North. So that was in the 60s. And then sometime in the early 80s, I had I was playing hockey. It was rat hockey. I showed up at a rink. Guy told me about a game. We showed up and play. And look at the goalie and got some freckles. It turns out that was Jay North. I played hockey with Dennis the Menace. He was in goal. We went out for a beer afterwards. No one more bitter than Jay North. He was Dennis the Menace. Nothing good ever happened to that. He lost a role in soap opera. I want to say Santa Barbara. He lost a role in Santa Barbara to Jack Ford, the president's son. And he just spent the entire time we had a beer grousing about it. And that was my experience with Dennis the Menace, with Jay North. And that's who it looked like in Nets. So there we go. Wait, what did we hear? Sully texted in. He likes Chance the Rabbi, or
he called you Lil Suckage.
Lil Suckage. There you go. All right. Thanks, Sully. We heard from him, and Sweet Cheeks texted me this emoji she made up for of herself: inside a dreidel, arms spread. Need my Dr. Dreidel to take me for a spin. So I need to get out of here. We are your station for Sunday coverage. The big game right here on The Score.
It wouldn't have been possible if we weren't here to be told how much we suck. So kudos to you guys for sucking as bad as we do.
Oh, yes. Wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
Wait.
Oh, yeah.
That's
it. A Suckage on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Got a lot to do here, Stevie Suckage, on Saturday Suckage, and not a lot of time to do it. We have to be off the air in time. You know why, don't you? Because at noon tomorrow, we have a secret radio show. At noon tomorrow, we have a secret radio show starring a man imitating Les Grobstein, replaying what Mark heard on The Score. Mark Rohde. Doing a show, 12 to 1 tomorrow. Another secret show at 3 in the morning after the Super Bowl. Trash Panda will be there. So there's your promotion, boys. That's about it. I can't use any.
You're trying to be a wise guy.
No,
I know
no.
what you're doing.
Can't use any of the words you tried to get me to say on the radio. Big game coverage on The Score Sunday is presented by Sota Weight Loss. That's S-O-T-A. Visit SotaWeightLoss.com. So guess who turned 80 this week? Couple days ago, Tommy DeVito. Well, the guy who played Tommy DeVito in the movie Goodfellas.
You mean? So, let me understand this, because maybe it's me. I'm a little f***ed up, maybe. But I'm funny. How? I mean, funny like I'm a clown. I amuse you. I make you laugh. I'm here to f***ing amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
I'm not just. You know how you tell a story? What?
No, I don't know. You said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. How the f*** am I funny? What the f*** is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's funny.
Get the f*** out of here, Tommy.
I almost had him. I almost had him. Stuttering prick yet? Frankie, was he shaking?
An iconic scene. And did you know Sean Sears? That was ad-libbed. That was not scripted.
Really?
It was not planned. Joe Pesci had talked to Martin Scorsese about it and said, I got this thing. I just want to spring it on Ray Liotta, and we're going to do it, and we're going to do it in the Bamboo Lounge, and we're going to end. That was it. And they all went along with it, and that's what that scene was. It was all.
I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown. I amuse you.
All unscripted. So that was Joe Pesci. He turned 80, and in my world, that's his greatest role. The second greatest role. Some people will agree with me, as Vincent Gambini, a lawyer in My Cousin Vinny, appearing before Honorable Judge in the South. Are we going to play that?
I don't know if I have the cut I'm looking for at all.
Oh, my God. Sean, you suck. All right, Utes. The two Utes. Did
okay.
you say
okay.
Utes? All right, we'll move along from there.
Oh, it's time to make your opening statement. Come on, Vin.
Everything that guy just says, thank you.
No more questions.
Yeah. All right. And Marisa Tomei won an Oscar for that. That was just my cousin Vinny. He was outstanding. And we lost someone who is legendary in our world here. Suzanne Hanrahan passed away at 83. That's how she is known by a lot, but a lot of Score listeners will know Suzanne Hanrahan as the wife of the estranged wife of the goalie Paul Newman taunts into running out of his net and beating him up when Paul Newman, as Reggie Dunlop, tells Hanrahan, hey, your wife's, well, maybe not what you thought she was. And Suzanne Hanrahan would go on to play, would also play, it just seems so opposite, her role in Slapshot, she would go on to play the mom in A Christmas Story. It couldn't be more. Melinda Dillon died this week at 83. So anyways, the Dennis the Menace story that I was telling you about, the Monterey County found its statue, missing statue of Dennis the Menace. There is a statue in Monterey County in California, Dennis the Menace, that got stolen, and they found it off the coast. And so they returned it to where it was. They knew it was because somebody broke off the statue of Dennis the Menace from the comic strip. And you knew him from the comic strip, right, Sean?
Yeah, that's what I had Dennis the Menace comics growing up.
In the 1960s, Dennis the Menace was a television show where he tormented Mr. Wilson.
We're going to have a nice, peaceful day in the country.
Ah, I can hardly wait.
Oh, Mr. Wilson!
That was it. That was Jay North. So that was in the 60s. And then sometime in the early 80s, I had I was playing hockey. It was rat hockey. I showed up at a rink. Guy told me about a game. We showed up and play. And I look at the goalie and, got some freckles. It turns out that was Jay North. I played hockey with Dennis the Menace. He was in goal. We went out for a beer afterwards. No one more bitter than Jay North. He was Dennis the Menace. Nothing good ever happened to that. He lost a role in a soap opera. I want to say Santa Barbara. He lost a role in Santa Barbara to Jack Ford, the president's son. And he just spent the entire time we had a beer grousing about it. And that was my experience with Dennis the Menace, with Jay North. And that's who it looked like in Nets. So there we go. Wait, what did we hear? Sully texted in. He likes Chance the Rabbi, or
he called you Lil Suckage.
Lil Suckage. There you go. All right. Thanks, Sully. We heard from him, and Sweet Cheeks texted me this emoji she made up of herself, inside a dreidel, arms spread, need my Dr. Dreidel to take me for a spin. So I need to get out of here. We are your station for Sunday coverage. The big game right here on The Score.
It wouldn't have been possible if we weren't here to be told how much we suck. So kudos to you guys for sucking as bad as we do.
Oh, yes. Wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
Wait.
Oh, yeah.
That's it.